Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Ira Naiman. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. This is the last of the special Kickstarter month podcasts. On February 28th, I launched a Kickstarter to fund an anthology called Shapers of Worlds, which will feature authors from the first year's podcasts. And I was very, very pleased with the number of authors who were able to agree to contribute that, either with original fiction or with reprints. And I'm very happy to say that as of today, as I'm recording this on March 28th, that Shapers of Worlds has fully funded, and we're now into the stretch goals section of it. And the stretch goals are simple. For every $1,500 I get above the $13,500 Canadian that's already been pledged, I will pay the authors another cent a word. So on the original fiction side, I have Tanya Huff, Shannon McGuire, David Weber, L.E. Modisett Jr., John C. Wright, Shelley Adina, Dave Butler, D.J. Butler, Christopher Rocchio, and me. And on the reprint side, there's John Scalzi, Joe Haldeman, David Brin, Julie Sharnada, Fonda Lee, Gareth L. Powell, Dr. Charles E. Gannon, Derek Kunskin, and Thorea Dyer. So look for original fiction from the ones I mentioned and reprints from the others, and that will all be coming out, I hope, around August is what I'm aiming for, the second year anniversary of the World Shapers podcast. Even though we are fully funded, the Kickstarter continues until noon Central Standard Time or Mountain Daylight Time. Saskatchewan doesn't change, so it's always a little confusing this time of year. On Monday, March 30th, so there's still lots of time, if you're hearing this before then, to get in. And there are some great backers rewards, like first readership from David Weber and an opportunity to have your name used as a character in stories. There's all sorts of great rewards there, and a lot of extra books and things like that as well. So please check out the Kickstarter at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds. And we'll see how high we can go and how much extra money I can pay the authors who have so generously offered to write or contribute a story to the Shapers of Worlds anthology, which I should also mention will be published by Shadowpaw Press, which is my little publishing company. Shadowpaw Press is named after our cat, in case you're wondering, and you can find it at shadowpawpress.com. All right, well, let's get on to this episode's guest, Ira Naiman. Ira Naiman is
the proprietor of the Alternate Reality News Service, which sends reporters into other universes and has them report on what they find there. There are 11 books in that series, the most recent of which is the omnibus volume Idiotocracy for Dummies. He is also the author of 6 novels in the Multiverse series, published by Elsewind Press. The latest is Good Intentions, the Multiverse Refugees Trilogy, First Pie in the Face. And we'll be talking about the Multiverse series in particular. In his spare time, Ira is the editor of Amazing Stories magazine. Yes, that Amazing Stories magazine, the very first one founded by Hugo Gernsback a very long time ago. In other lives, Ira has been a writer, performer in radio sketch comedy groups and created several as yet unproduced television series. He has a PhD in communications from McGill University and taught part-time for 5 years in the new media program at Ryerson University. So I guess I'll say, do I have to call you doctor or can I just call you Ira?
You can just call me Ira. I'm not really keen on the honorific.
Good. Well, Ira, welcome to the World Shapers.
Pleasure being here.
Now, we've run into each other over the years a few times, and I particularly think I ran into you about 4 times when you were handing out copies of Amazing at the Hugo's a couple of years ago. So,
yep.
So we're both in the Canadian science fiction circle, so that's a fairly small group of people, too.
A wonderful group of people, though. I have made so many friends in the Canadian science fiction community. It's since I started going to conventions about 10 years ago, and it was one of the most pleasant surprises for me to really be welcomed in this community.
We're a welcoming bunch. So let's take you back into the mists of time, as I always say to people. And how did you, well, first of all, where did you grow up and all that sort of thing? But then how did you become interested in science fiction and fantasy, and both as a reader and then as a writer?
Well, so I'm Toronto born and bred. I decided to devote my life to writing, not science fiction. Actually, my major project is comedy. I decided that I wanted to be a comedy writer when I was 8 years old. The first things I actually wrote were parodies of Sherlock Holmes stories, which I was reading at the time. I was a bit precocious. And I remember specifically that I was using the back of my dad's accounting ledgers. They were legal-sized sheets of paper. I couldn't use the front because there were crisscrossing multicolored lines. The fronts were too busy, but I did manage to write three stories, one per page. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, how do writers manage to think of so much detail to put into their stories? Obviously, from the introduction you gave me, over the years, I must have figured it out.
So how old were you when you started doing that?
Well, I started doing funny stuff when I was eight, which is now over 50 years. And one of the things that I've often maintained is that if you pursue anything as long as I have, there are only sort of two paths you can take. The first path is you never learn anything, and so you're mediocre and stay mediocre for your entire life. I hope I have taken the second path, which is with each new project, you learn and you grow as a writer. And so hopefully by now I'm at the top of my game. Now, I only actually answered half of your question. The other half of the question was about science fiction specifically. So, I mean, when I was a kid, I used to watch Star Trek. I remember being blown away when I first saw 2001, A Space Odyssey. And although, as I often mention, I was actually a mystery geek before I was a science fiction geek, eventually I did start reading science fiction. And I always say, you know, I started with the ABCs. Asimov, Bradbury, and Clark. So I had a good grounding in kind of the classics of science fiction. I did that. I read that for maybe 10 or 15 years. Felt that I had kind of gotten it. I knew what science fiction was about and moved away from it for a while. Got back into science fiction in a major way when I discovered cyberpunk in the 80s. That was something new and at the time very exciting, although now it's kind of past its best due date, I guess. It's run its course as a subgenre, I think. But then not only was it something that I could go back and enjoy reading, but I could also think about combining science fiction with the humor I was always writing anyway.
Now, somewhere along in there, you went to university and you ended up with a PhD in communications. What did you study as an undergraduate?
Well, actually, okay, so my undergrad degree is a BFA from York. It's a, and I haven't actually said this in a while, so it's a long one. It's a Bachelor of Fine Arts in interdisciplinary media with a concentration in creative writing.
Uh-huh.
So basically, it was a creative writing degree, but through the fine arts department instead of humanities. So I took 3 years of screenwriting. That was kind of for my major, and a lot of fine arts courses. At the time, as I think I mentioned, you mentioned in the introduction, I did a lot of screenwriting. I went through a decade when I was writing screenplays, and I have, through that period, I'd written about 100. So I know my way around a screenplay as well as prose writing. My master's degree was done with Paul Levinson at his online school, Connected Education, which at the time was affiliated with the New School for Social Research. So my degree is actually from the Institute in New York, even though I was still living in Toronto. I was very interested in the intersection between new media and old storytelling. So my master's degree was, my master's thesis was about interactive storytelling and some of the challenges that interactive storytelling as a new medium for storytelling, some of the challenges that it had for storytellers. Wow, that was a lot of story in one sentence, wasn't it? My PhD was in a similar vein. It was, I looked at writers who were putting their short fiction on the internet. My questions were, so why do they do that? What are the advantages of publishing online versus publishing in traditional print? And discovered a lot of very interesting things. Now, you know, now, of course, everybody publishes online. It's the thing to do, and everybody knows this. But actually, you know, I wrote my dissertation 20 years ago in the year 2000. And at the time, the internet was kind of a shiny new toy for writers. And so although a lot of the ideas that we now take for granted, at the time I wrote my dissertation, they were actually quite fresh and new. I'm still very proud of that work.
I always ask authors who had formal writing training, because not everybody did. Some of the most successful writers never had any formal training in the field of writing. Have you found that the academic side of this has been beneficial to your writing over the years?
Well, you know, I took 3 years of screenwriting, and in those 3 years, I only had really two positive experiences.
Oh, dear.
But, I mean, you know, one of them was actually quite substantially positive. So screenwriting was there were second, third, and fourth year courses. I decided when I went to York that I really wanted to get into screenwriting, even though I wasn't at that time even a fine arts major, let alone a film major. I was never a film major, actually. So I submitted a portfolio to the professor, and he let me in my first year. And one of the things I quickly found out was that all of the students in the screenwriting course were second-year film majors, and they all knew each other because they had, of course, worked on each other's first-year film projects. And I found it very intimidating, and I found it very hard. I was a very shy person, as a lot of writers are. And I was talking to the teacher about, I don't know, two-thirds of the way through the course, and I said, you know, I'm very uncomfortable here because I don't feel I can get to know anybody. And he said to me, you know, you should not be worried about them. They should be worried about you, because you know how to tell a story. And you know, for somebody who was starting his writing career and uncertain of his abilities, that was a very big boost. That was a very important moment for me. The other moment was just in fourth year. I submitted a screenplay to my fourth year professor. I ended up with an A in the course, but the professor said, you know, there is one thing you should really watch out for, and that is that you want to, from what I've seen of your writing, you seem to want to make every character be able to spout one-liners, right? and that's, you know, you can have a character do that, one, maybe two, But all the characters tend to start sounding the same. And in real life, people, of course, are not like that. And so, you know, that was perhaps the best piece of writing advice I ever got. It made me rethink how I approach comedy and realize that comedy is better when it bubbles up out of the interaction between the characters and the plot. And I mean, that was important for screenwriting. In prose, I play a lot of language games. I have humor coming from a lot of different sources. But in terms of, you know, character and story, it sent me in a much more productive direction than I had been going. So I'll always be grateful for that.
Now, screenwriting is quite different from writing a novel, obviously, just in playwriting. I've done playwriting. I haven't done a lot of screenwriting. But did you find some valuable insights into writing prose while you were learning to write screenplays? Aside from what you just mentioned, but, you know, just in the way that the story is told.
Well, you still have to, I mean, the basics of storytelling are the basics of storytelling, no matter what medium you work in. So, I mean, you still have to have involving characters, and you still have to have a story that sucks in the participant, the viewer, the reader, whichever medium you have, whichever person is appropriate to the medium you're working in. That having been said, I mean, I've also written for radio. I've also written for a bit of interactive media. And each medium has its own features that get overlaid over the basics. But what I find is that once you have the basics of storytelling down, then learning the craft of each medium is easily doable.
And you mentioned writing for radio, and you were a writer and a performer in a radio sketch comedy groups, your bio mentioned.
Yep.
How did that all come about?
Well, so I had been, while I was an undergrad at York, I had been volunteering for the community radio station, CHRY, that was based at York University. And I knew a guy, I knew the head of the spoken word program at CHRY. He was a film major, and we had taken a couple of film courses together, and he invited me to work on actually a literary show for the radio station. So I was the host of a literary show for a couple of years. And I don't know, maybe 6 months or a year into my stay there, we realized that we both had a love for sketch comedy. And the radio station gave us the resources. You know, it gave us a recording studio and editing facilities and all of that stuff. And we thought, well, you know, if we're ever going to do this, this would be the time to do it. So we did. We got a couple of other guys that we knew. We auditioned for other performers, and we ended up with, I think, 3 or 4 really brilliant female comedians. And we did it. Now, our original intention was that we were just going to be writers. Unfortunately, what happened was the male performers that we auditioned for the show were not very good. And so most of them we ended up letting go after the first recording session, which, of course, left us with a performing hole. So we ended up getting dragooned into doing it. Like I said, I was the way I think of myself now is as a recovering shy person. But at the time, I hadn't gone through recovery yet. So I was very trepidatious about doing any performing. So they gave me a couple of straight man roles to begin with. But what I found was that in the studio, when it's just me and the other performers, there's no audience, and I have the script in front of me because there's no reason not to, I got fairly comfortable with it. And so they started giving me crazier and crazier roles. And one of the things I had learned from watching a lot of sketch comedy, from watching a lot of, you know, film comedy, is that if you perform it, you have to be 100% committed to whatever you're doing. No matter how crazy, no matter how out of control it seems, if there's any hesitation in the performance, it gets communicated to the viewer or listener, and it kills the comedy right there. So to everybody's surprise, including mine, I rose to that occasion and did some really crazy stuff. And as soon as they realized that I could do that, they started sending some of the crazier characters my way. And it was a ball. I love that. I would love to do more radio comedy. I would love to do film voiceover comedy. You know, that was a lot of fun.
It's interesting what you said about if you're not 100% committed, it can kill the comedy. I think that carries over into prose as well. If you're not 100% committed to what you're writing and the style at which you're attacking the comedy or the tragedy or whatever you're writing, you kill the book too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was, I have a short story in an anthology called Forbidden, and I got my contributor's copies a few days ago, and I'm reading through the anthology, and one of the things I realized was, that my voice as a prose writer is very different from anything else that's in that book. It really sensitized me to the idea that when people reject my short stories when I send them to magazines or anthologies, they actually have a really good reason. What I do is kind of out there for the science fiction genre. But as you say, once I realized that that humor was the way that I would go, I committed to it, right? Now, my voice is probably unique in the genre, but it is my voice, and I cannot, and I've tried. I've tried doing classic sitcoms, and they were terrible, right? Because after 50 years, I'm thoroughly committed to my voice. And what I usually tell people at conventions when I meet them is, okay, this is not for everybody. This is I can't guarantee that you're going to like this, but the people who do like it really love it.
Yes, I would have to say, having delved into your multiverse series, that you do have a voice I don't believe I've encountered anywhere else. So it is unique and very funny too. So that's,
well, thank you. Well, you know, let me switch hats for just a moment. You know, one of the things I find, because I read a lot of other people's short stories for the magazine, and one of the things I find, and I think people are taught this at like writing schools and places like that. But a lot of writers don't have a unique voice. And one of the things that I have stressed as the editor of the magazine, Amazing Stories, is that is what I'm looking for. If this story that you submit could have been written by half a dozen or a dozen or God knows how many other people, you lose points with me, right? I'm looking for people with a unique voice, and unfortunately, I don't find it nearly as often as I would like.
When did you actually start publishing stuff yourself?
Well, there are different sort of levels of that. Yeah. Three of the first things I published, actually. So the Alternate Reality News Service is an offshoot of a project of mine that goes back to the 1980s called Les Pages au Fol, which is a project of political and social satire. And when I was growing up, the prose writer I wanted to most be was actually a guy named Art Buchwald, who in the 50s and 60s was just the best political satirist. Great writer.
We're almost exactly the same age, so I get all your references.
I appreciate that. Because, you know, I know a lot of people I meet are like, what? And, you know, I sometimes, if I'm feeling generous, I'll tell them. So Art Buchwald, he's the guy who sued, I believe, Paramount Pictures, claiming that Eddie Murphy had stolen the idea for Coming to America from an Art Buchwald screenplay, and won. And the studio had to open up its books to Art Buchwald, and we all discovered how really shabby Hollywood bookkeeping is through this.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a great book on it, the name of which I'm blanking out on, but it's worth reading. That was where I learned the term monkey points. Are you familiar with the term monkey points?
I remember that term. Yeah.
Yep. But so anyway, yeah, I knew Art Buchwald from well before that, and he is who I wanted to be. So there was this magazine when I was younger called Comic Relief. And what Comic Relief did was it reprinted the best editorial cartoons of the previous month, and also a few, maybe three or four humor columns from newspaper humor columns. And they also, every month, would feature a different visual artist, a different political cartoonist, somebody who wanted to break in, who submitted stuff directly to them. So I thought, okay, they also carry prose columns. So I submitted several of my columns and said, would you, you know, publish this on your amateur page? And they did. So that would have been like the very first thing that somebody else had published of mine. They published three of my stories. And my payment was a subscription for life. Now, they only lasted a few more years, but that was good enough for me. That was that would have been the first thing that that I had ever had published.
Okay, so it turned out to be a subscription for the life of the magazine, not for your life.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
What about fiction and actual stories and that sort of thing, and especially in the science fiction? How did you finally start writing science fiction stories and eventually novels?
Well, so what happened was on my website, Les Pages au Folles, I had started writing like fake news articles. And at some point it occurred to me that it would be great to create this news agency that created these news articles. And the concept, because I was steeped in science fiction, was that that they got their news from alternate realities. And so it was called the Alternate Reality News Service. And I started writing those articles for my website. And at some point, maybe about 15 years ago, I was thinking, okay, so how can I promote this? How can I get more people interested in my writing? And I had a couple of different paths open to me. I could try to promote the humor of it and try to promote the satirical end of it, or I could try to promote the science fiction end of it. And the thing about that was that I quickly realized that there aren't that many satire conventions, but there are plenty of science fiction conventions. So for purely promotional terms, I started collecting Alternate Reality News Service stories into self-published books. The first one was called Alternate Reality Ain't What It Used to Be, and I just kind of went from there. Now, of course, when you have an alternate reality news service, everything looks like an alternate reality story. So publishing the first book encouraged me to write more of them, and so I could get a second book. Now, as I believe you mentioned in the introduction, there are 11 volumes in that series. And that continues. I continue to write new articles for the website, and eventually there will be another volume there. In terms of novels, I never actually saw myself as a novelist. I was quite happy to continue to write short stories and short stories. But about a decade ago, I came across this writing contest that was specifically for first novels, specifically for humorous first novels, and it was sponsored and was going to be judged by Terry Pratchett. And I thought, this was an opportunity made for me. One of the things you learn very quickly when you want to enter a novel writing contest is, of course, that you kind of have to write a novel to do it.
Funny that.
So that's what spurred me to write my first novel. I wrote my first novel just shy. I finished the first draft just shy of my 50th birthday. Okay, so it didn't go anywhere in the contest. But so now I'm thinking, okay, I have this novel. What am I going to do with it? So it took me a couple of years. I sort of sporadically was looking for a publisher for my novel. I heard that there was this relatively new publisher, Elsewhen Press, and they had the advantage of being based in Britain. Friends of mine had been telling me, you know, you really have kind of a British sense of humor, a British sensibility. You should be looking at England as a market. So, okay, I sent a query letter to Peter Buck at Elsewhen Press. He sent me back a response. Hello, thank you for querying us. I've taken a look at some of your material online, and you seem absolutely bonkers. Just the kind of person we want to write for us. Please send me the first three chapters of your novel. It went from there, and eventually he bought the first novel. I have to say two things I learned from this story, or two things I try and teach from this story. The first is, if you put yourself out there on the internet, you never know how that's going to have a positive effect on your writing, right? I may have sold him the novel without being all over the internet, but it certainly did kind of help that process along. And the other thing I'll just say is two years is a stupid short amount of time to write, to sell a novel to a publisher. I have friends, I have one friend, it took him 7 years to sell his first novel. I have another friend who has sold other novels, but has never sold his first novel in 15 or 20 years since he wrote it. So I recognize just how lucky I was that I managed to find somebody who, for whom my work resonated.
We're going to talk about the Multiverse series in a little more detail, but before we do that, I want to find out about the Amazing Stories thing. How did you end up as editor of Amazing Stories when it returned to print a couple of years ago?
Well, that, again, so what I usually tell people is that to have any sort of degree of success as a writer, you need two qualities. One, you need to be very lucky, and two, you need to work your ass off. So, again, as a promotional thing, maybe 4 years ago now, I decided to volunteer for the Amazing Stories website. I started writing book reviews and the occasional analytical editorial for them. And I did that for about a year and a half. Then the publisher of the website, Steve Davidson, he had a personal tragedy that he had to deal with, and he asked me if I would be willing to take over the website maintenance and editing while he dealt with that. And I was like, yeah, I can do that. My only sort of stipulation was that I knew that at some point he wanted to revive Amazing Stories as an ongoing fiction magazine. And so I asked him, if that ever comes to pass, I would like to have an editorial position. I ran the website for about a year and a half. So at that point, I had been volunteering for about 3 years. Did the work. He comes back. He takes back the website. But he also says, you know, Amazing Stories is now being revived as a TV series, which should give us an influx of cash. This might be the time to revive the magazine. And so I was like, okay, great. Yeah, sure. He asked me to be editor, which was not actually what I was expecting. I was expecting him to get a more experienced editor, and I'd maybe be assistant editor. But one thing I find is that I often rise to these occasions. And so I took it on, and it's been just an amazing experience dealing with some amazing writers, some amazing artists, and yeah, it even got me to a Worldcon.
Have you been surprised by anything as editor? Was it not what you expected in some way?
Well, I never expected to be a magazine editor, so I had no expectations of what the experience would be like.
That's helpful.
It has definitely been a learning curve in some ways, more in the background than in the actual editing. Editing is something that I have done in a fair bit of in the past, so I'm good with working with writers and working with words. But one of the things that surprised me was the gusher of stories.
I was going to ask you about that.
When we opened for submissions, we got 100 submissions on the first day. We got 250 submissions in the first week. In the first year of submissions, we got over 2,000. I had to do a lot of the reading because at that point we didn't have a lot of slush readers. And it was a deluge. It was, you know, hard to keep up with it. But fortunately, I shored up the slush readers, positions, and we got over it. We dealt with it.
And how are things going for the magazine?
We've been in a hiatus for a couple of months, but I'm happy to say that that the sixth issue should be out within the next month, and we're gearing up to go back into production. So,
but with the delay on this, that should mean it'll be out just before this comes out, I would think. Then this
okay.
Podcast, so
great. We're aiming for the end of February, early March.
It'll be about the time this goes live, I think. So,
perfect. And I'll be honest with you. However it plays out, what I tell people in at conventions is that the first issue came out in April of 1926, and my dream is that we can keep it going until 2026, so that we can have a 100th anniversary issue.
That'd be cool.
That'd be very sweet. But, you know, if we can do that, or if it, you know, if it doesn't last the year, either way, it's been a tremendous experience. And I'm very grateful that that Steve gave me the opportunity.
Well, now let's talk about your multiverse series and your writing process of that. First of all, give a synopsis, if you can, of all those books, or at least the overall setting.
Okay. Well, so the idea is that travel between universes is possible, but it's very carefully monitored. In the first book, there is a chapter that deals specifically with what happens when you let people wander willy-nilly between universes, and it's ugly. You don't want that to happen. So there is an organization called the Transdimensional Authority. They are essentially the multiverse police. If you're somewhere where you shouldn't be, doing something you shouldn't be doing, they're the ones who find you, stop you, and take you back to where you belong. Each novel is self-contained. You can read them in any order, but each novel builds on that concept in some ways. In the third novel, I introduce a sister agency called the Time Agency, which polices time travel in the same way that the Transdimensional Authority polices multiverse travel. And the fourth novel is actually a time travel novel, but it's time travel set within the multiverse, which does some interesting things to the concept of time travel. The most recent book is the sixth in the series, Good Intentions. And it actually explores a different function of the Transdimensional Authority. The first five books look at its policing function, but it's also a political bureaucracy. When new universes are found, the Transdimensional Authority sends agents to the new universe to make contact and to establish relations with the new universe. And that's very much what the trilogy is about. It starts with the discovery that a universe is about to collapse, thanks to the machinations of the main character in the second book. But you don't need to know that. There's enough explanation that you can get sort of what's happening. And the Transdimensional Authority has the bright idea of taking all the 17 billion sentient creatures out of the collapsing universe and taking them into stable universes. So it's the, you know, the biggest refugee project you can imagine. The first book in the trilogy is about the first person, the first alien who comes to Earth Prime, and is about how that person is treated and how they have to adjust to living in a new world. In the second book, which I'm currently halfway through writing, it takes place 2 years later. Several million aliens have come to Earth Prime, have been relocated now. And there is starting to be some pushback from speciesist humans who are not happy that that the aliens are coming to their planet. And the third novel, I've planned out sort of the tone of them. Each of the novels gets progressively darker as human beings get progressively more and more anti-alien. Still within a comedic setting, but the satire, I guess, becomes darker and darker.
So what was the genesis of all this? It's a cliche to say, where do you get your ideas? But where did you get your idea for this?
Well, I'm going to bracket the ideas thing because I do have a story about ideas that is illustrative of my process. So what happened was, when I decided to write a novel, I fell back on things that had already been, a lot of ideas that had already been in place in the alternate reality news service. So the Transdimensional Authority, for instance, had been mentioned in several alternate reality news service articles. So I sort of ran with that and expanded it outward. I filled it out with new characters and new situations. But a lot of the ideas for that first novel were already there. In terms of where you get your ideas, where I get my ideas. So the thing about being an artist, and I've talked about this when I was teaching at Ryerson. I mentioned this to my production students. The thing about being an artist is you have to be open to anything that the universe sends you. Being an artist is a 24/7 occupation because you never know what is going to spark that idea. So, to give you the strangest example, I used to be a member of a science fiction book club in Toronto. Every month we would read a new book. And one month, the book that was listed on the website was The Dragons of Bagel by Michael Swanwick. And I thought, that's an awesome title. I want to read that book. Who doesn't want to read a book about dragons and delicatessens? Awesome stuff. The problem, of course, as I found out a week later, was that it was a typo. Anybody familiar with Michael Swanwick's work will know that the book is actually called The Dragons of Babel, not Babel. And once I got over my disappointment, I realized, oh, wait, that idea is free. That hasn't been done yet. So if you've read my second novel, you know that there is a chapter called The Dragon of the Bagel. And the chapter does, in fact, feature both dragons and a delicatessen. Now, partially, I mean, this is kind of humor training, right? Where you take whatever the world gives you and just work with it. But it's also, it's just a good sort of thing to, a good sort of thing to cultivate. What I tell my students, what I'm telling your listeners is that the world is an artist's raw material. So you got to take from wherever you possibly can. In terms of inspiration, I'll mention just one other thing. A couple of years ago, I was part of a role-playing game. It wasn't D&D. It was actually a science fiction role-playing game called Worlds Without Number. And I played the character of a little blue alien. He's 4 feet tall. He wears an exquisite three-piece suit. He always has a briefcase with him. And out of the briefcase, he can pull anything that he wants. The briefcase, the bottomless briefcase is the bottomless box, actually, is an old comic trope. And I had a lot of fun with that in the game. And I also, at that time, was starting to develop the ideas for what would become the Multiverse Refugees trilogy. And so I told the other players, like, flat out, I'm playing this character to research the aliens that I will be using in my novel. And the thing about role-playing games is that you actually do a tremendous amount of thinking about your character. So by the time we stopped playing the game, we played for about a year on and off. I knew what my alien race's history was. I knew what their sexuality was. I knew what their religion was. I had all of these things that were ready to go as soon as I was ready to start writing the novel. I probably won't use half of the ideas that I actually developed in playing the game, but it was an incredibly useful exercise for me in world shaping, basically. And again, if you're into that sort of thing, that can be a great tool to spur creativity.
What does your planning look like when you launch into one of these books? Do you do an outline? Do you just have a general idea and kind of run with it? So, how are you, a plotter or a pantser? That's the usual way to ask that.
I am very much a plotter. I need to know the beginning. I need to know the end. And I need to know many of the major beats along the way. That having been said, though, and you've read some of my writings, so you'll know that there is a lot going on, sometimes on a line-by-line basis, certainly on a paragraph-by-paragraph basis. So for me, the plot is only the beginning. And what I find is that I do a lot of pantsing in the actual writing of whatever it happens to be. So in some ways, I think I'm both. And in some ways, I think everybody's both. I don't think anybody is purely one or the other.
You rarely talk to somebody who doesn't say, yeah, I had an outline, but I somewhere along the way it changes completely. So that happens all the time to all of us, I think. And what's your actual writing process like? Are you a speedy writer, a slow writer? Do you write with a quill pen under a tree outside, or how does that work for you?
When I started writing, it was all handwritten first drafts, partially because this is long ago, and I actually started writing on a manual typewriter.
Ah, so did I.
Yep. And, you know, it still shows because sometimes somebody will catch me banging the keys on my laptop. And it's like, you know, you don't have to press them that hard. And it's like, I can't help it. It's how I was brought up.
Yeah, I beat the heck out of my keyboards.
Yeah. It's just it's a hard habit to break. When I got computers, what I found was that I would write, I think, screenplays directly onto the computer, but I still wrote prose in longhand, which was a weird dichotomy for a long time. But eventually even that sort of faded away, and I eventually ended up writing everything directly onto my computer. But here's the thing. So I live in North York, which is a suburb of Toronto. What I usually say is I live far enough north that I'm so far north, but I'm still just barely within the city limits, the greater Toronto area city limits. So I have an hour commute to get downtown. And one of the things that I've gone back to now is when I'm on the subway, I do a lot of longhand writing again and then just come home and type it up. That's important to me to maximize my creative time. So whenever I have an opportunity, if I'm waiting at the doctor's office or whatever, if I've got 10 or 15 minutes, I just might write a few paragraphs in longhand. So now it's really a hybrid of whatever my day gives me the time to do.
And once you have a draft, what does your revision process look like?
Well, I do what I think of as a rolling edit. So if I'm working on a chapter, I will start, you know, the first few pages, you know, maybe get 1,000 words. I aim for 1,000 words a day. Sometimes I get 2, sometimes I don't get any, you know, but, you know, I try to get a word count just to keep things moving forward. So I'll write my 1,000 words, and then the next day I'll go back and rework what I did the day before and then start writing the new stuff. Mm. So actually, you know, I do one full edit once I've got a first draft, partially because there are so many moving parts in a lot of my stories that I need to make sure that everything fits together smoothly, that nothing sort of sticks out as being odd or doesn't quite fit. But a lot of the editing actually I find comes in the process of the writing itself. So by the time I do that, that whole draft edit, it's more of a polish than any serious sort of storytelling edit.
And then once it gets to Elsewhen, what's their editorial process like?
Well, it's that back and forth, right? So they'll send me a version of my draft in, and they'll have all sorts of comments and edits in, track changes. Oftentimes, because as I've mentioned, I do a lot with language, and oftentimes their comments are, did you mean to write it this way, or is this a typo? And 99 times out of 100, I actually meant to write it that way, because I make up a lot of words and there's a lot of wordplay and stuff.
So there are comments like, crazy.
Sorry?
Drives copy editors crazy.
Indeed.
Up a lot of words.
Indeed. But I mean, after 6 books, they're kind of used to me by now. And it's a back and forth. Until we're all sort of satisfied that the manuscript is the best it can be. There is only one instance that I can think of where Peter actually downright refused to do something. He put his foot down and said, I couldn't do it, which was a shame because I really liked it. But other than that, it's negotiation.
Now, it is humor, and humor mm-hmm. can be quite subjective. Do they ever come back to you and just say, that's not funny? Or do you get that from readers sometimes that you said that, you know, some people really like it, some people really don't warm up to it?
Well, you know, there are a couple of sort of ways I can respond to that. No, Peter doesn't. I have never had the response from the publisher that this is not funny. What you find, and my sort of theory of comedy, but what you find is that my humor. So what I say is that I learned the basics of comedy from two primary sources, the Marx Brothers and Monty Python's Flying Circus. And I learned two V's, what I think of as the two V's, velocity and variety. So with both of those groups, the one thing you'll know right off the bat is that they're throwing jokes at you and bits of humor at you all the time. Constantly. Humor, 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 humor. And I try to maintain that pace. But the thing about that is that a major element of humor is surprise. You have to be able to surprise the viewer or the reader. They don't see it coming. And if you do the same thing, so that's velocity. If you do the same thing over and over, if you use the same type of humor over and over again, the reader or viewer is going to catch up with you. They're going to say, oh, I know what's coming next because you've done it so many times. So what you need to do is use every possible comic device and mix them up constantly so that the reader will not ever see a joke coming, or unless part of the joke is that you've telegraphed it and that's your intent. Now, because and that's the variety V. Because there's so much humor going on, and because there's so many different kinds of humor, I don't expect every reader to get every joke. What I, my sort of working assumption on how people will read my books is that they will hopefully find maybe 75, 80, 90% of the jokes. And so once they put the book down, it'll be like, that was funny. I enjoyed that. Some people will get exhausted by the volume of humor, and I think that's where a lot of people might have problems with my writing. My novel lengths generally are 80,000 words. I shoot for 80,000 words, and I know that for science fiction novels, the sweet spot is considered to be 100 to 120,000 words. But I have yet to encounter a reader who thought, gypped, who thought, you know, they didn't get enough. In fact, just the opposite. I'm concerned about tiring readers out. I don't think that that's a problem. There is a joke in my second novel. It's a joke that I loved so much that it's actually on the cover. I asked them to do an illustration of that particular scene. The main villain in my second novel is a man named Jerry Cornelius. And the transdimensional authority figures track him to his lair, which is a converted car repair shop that has been concreted over, and there's no clear way of getting into it. One of the transdimensional authority investigators turns to the other one and says, "It's a garage." And the second one says, "Yeah, and it's airtight." And I could take 5 minutes to explain that joke. I've told it to a couple of people, and only one person actually had the cultural references to get the joke. But one of the things that you know, I've known for a long time.
Yeah, not that one person, I admit.
Do you want me to explain it?
Sure.
Okay.
Maybe I know the references and I just haven't made the connection.
You probably know some of the references, but not all of them. So Jerry Cornelius is not my original character. Jerry Cornelius was actually created by Michael Moorcock in a trilogy of novels that that were collected called the Cornelius Chronicles. He was a character that I loved, and when I knew sort of what the plot was of the novel, I asked Michael Moorcock if I could use the character, and he said yes. That it was not sort of a shot in the dark. In the 1980s, Moorcock said essentially, hey, you know what? Anybody who wants to use the character of Jerry Cornelius is welcome to it. Go at it. And a lot of people did. Apparently, Moorcock was less than enamored of the results, and maybe a decade later, he rescinded the permission. But during that time, there was a French artist named Mobius, mm-hmm. who was a contributor to a magazine called Metal Hurlant, right. which in English actually translates to screaming metal, but the English version we got was, of course, heavy metal.
Yeah.
And
I like screaming metal better, too. But anyway.
It's a great title, actually. It's a great name. He wrote a comic strip, a recurring storyline for heavy metal, called The Airtight Garage of Jerry Cornelius.
Oh.
Right? So not only do you need to know Moorcock's history, but you also need to know heavy metal. It just so happened that the person who got the joke was a Mobius fan. He was a fan of the artist, so that's why he knew about the Airtight Garage cartoon.
And I'm only at the level of knowing that these people existed and the magazine existed, and that's about it.
Exactly. But like I say, you know, so the point about volume is that it's okay if somebody doesn't get a joke, because there's another one right after it, and another one right after that, and another one right after that. So like I say, as long as people get enough that they've been laughing throughout, they'll enjoy it. And sometimes you just got to do it for yourself.
Well, I do a lot of theater, and I have a very good friend who's writes a lot of comedic theater stuff. And we both have used the expression, you know, some jokes you're just doing for that one guy in the very back of the auditorium. He's the only one that's going to get it, but he's going to get it, and it's going to be his favorite joke ever. So even if it goes over everybody else's head, at least somebody is getting a reward out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're really out of time, but I have to ask you the big philosophical question. And of course, there is no really out of time on this podcast, because I'm the only person I have to answer to. So why do you do this? Why do you write, and why do you think any of us write? And particularly, why do you write comedy and science fiction?
Okay. Why do I write comedy? Most writers tend to be introspective, and I am definitely an overthinker. I would never argue with that. So this is a question that I've been thinking about for a long time. I mean, you're 8 years old. Who knows what they want to do when they're 8 years old, right? Most people want to be, you know, cowboys or firemen or astronauts or whatever. Not many people, you know, want to be writers from such a young age. Although I will quickly tell a story. I was watching an interview with the great British comedian Eddie Izzard, and he was talking about how he first met his idol Richard Pryor. The two of them started talking, and they realized that they actually had something in common. They both knew that they wanted to be stand-up comedians from when they were 4 years old. And I thought, wow. I thought I was precocious, but when I wanted to be a writer when I was 8 years old, actually, I was already half a lifetime behind the curve. But I've thought about it a lot, and the best answer I can come to you for wanting to write humor is, like many people in comedy, I had an unhappy childhood. My home life was fraught with rage and arguments. My dad was a Holocaust survivor. He came to Canada when he was about 10 years old. As an orphan, his parents were killed in a concentration camp. His parents were actually taken by the Nazis in front of him. He was an angry man when I was growing up, and our household was angry. And one of the things I guess I knew, even at that young age, was that laughter made me feel good. And so I was hoping to, first off, make myself laugh. But also, you know, looking back at it, I thought, well, maybe if I could make my parents laugh, things wouldn't be so bad. I don't know. That didn't really actually do very much. Therapy helped us all. So I don't know how well that worked, but it did set me on the path that I've taken over my life. In terms of science fiction, so one of the things I learned when I started telling stories for film and TV was that science fiction gives me a whole bunch of tropes that I can use for comic effect. I can make aliens funny. I can make robots funny. I can make travel between universes funny in ways that sticking with, you know, reality, sticking with sort of traditional storytelling, I couldn't do. So there are a lot of things that I love doing with science fiction that I couldn't do with straight fiction. I mean, I'll give you an example because it's very much in my mind right now. There is an author who is getting a lot of flack. She has written a novel about immigrants, but she herself is not of that particular immigrant culture that she writes about. And people have complained that she's been getting the immigrant culture wrong, that she's her novel is superficial and doesn't deal with the reality of the people who she's writing about. So I'm writing about my trilogy. It's right there in the title. It's about the refugee experience. It's about refugees. And partially that's because, as I said, a large number of my family came to North America as refugees. So refugees are in my family background. But, you know, you scratch most Canadians and most Canadians will say that, yeah, they have refugee backgrounds as well. So I think this is a universal sort of thing, a universal theme, and especially in this political moment, a very fraught universal theme. So it was very important for me to tell these stories. But what science fiction does is it allows me to tell them from the point of view of aliens, which is a culture that I've totally made up. So people can't complain that I'm getting their culture wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So people can concentrate not so much on the specifics, but on the universal, what the refugees in my stories are going through and how that relates to what human refugees have gone through in the past. So there are a lot of good reasons why I write science fiction. And also, I just love it. I'm just a fan.
Well, what are you working on now? You mentioned you're halfway through the next book in the Multiverse series. Do you have anything else on the go?
So, yes. the weird thing is that I had originally intended to write a trilogy, but a good friend and tech goddess, Gisela McKay, has been trying to get me to write a young adult novel for many years now, because she thinks, you know, that my writing would appeal to young people, which I don't disagree. So I wrote the first novel in the trilogy, and then I wrote a short story for For the Brave New Girls anthology. I don't know if you're familiar with Brave New Girls, but it's a series of anthologies about young women, and each story has to have a speculative component, and it also has to feature a young woman who is interested in one of the STEM areas of research. And all of the proceeds go to funds for young women who want to be scientists, who want to do something in STEM. I think it's a great idea, wholly supported. I've bought all the books, and I'd love to get a story in one of their anthologies. So I wrote this short story. It's called How Frady Failed Mr. Tenenbaum's History Class. And it got rejected. Lovely rejection. They loved the story. They just didn't think it was right for them, and they asked me to submit again. But now I have this short story, and it could really have been, it really was, I really sort of envisioned it as the start of a novel. So I took a break from the trilogy and wrote that novel. It's called Frady's Amazeballs Argyle's Adventure, and it's currently at my publisher. So in a perfect world, what's going to happen is I got the first novel in the trilogy out. Frady's novel is going to be published, because Frady's novel, although it isn't part of the trilogy directly, it takes place in the world of the trilogy. So it dovetails very nicely into what's happening in the trilogy. The second book in the trilogy, which I'm currently writing, will be published. Then I've got a second Frady novel, Frady's Amazeballs Ultronaut Academy Adventure, and then the third book in the trilogy will come out. And so instead of three books, I've ended up with five now in this story arc. So I'm, you know, constantly sort of developing the ideas for the next two novels. But keep in mind that I also update my website weekly. So there's always new social and political satire going up on my website. So I actually, you know, I'm working on a number of different things. I just, the other day, just literally yesterday, I saw a call for short stories for an anthology that's being edited by a friend of mine. And I'm like, Yeah, I could do that too. This would be very cool. So, you know, I'm always working on a bunch of different stuff. And as people who do this will tell you, one of the great things about having multiple sort of projects on the go is that if the creativity isn't flowing for one project, I just move to another one. And what I often find is that that creeps the creativity flowing.
And where are the places that people find you online?
My website is Les Pages aux Folles, LESPAGESAUXFOLLES, all one word, .ca. I am on Facebook. I am on Twitter.
And what's your handle on Twitter?
Do a search on my name. My name is fairly distinctive.
Okay, and I'll put a link in. There you go.
I think I believe it's Arne's proprietor. Proprietor of the Alternate Reality News Service. But I always get Twitter and Facebook confused, and keeping track of the identities is just, keeping track of my one identity is hard enough for me. So that's just too much.
Well, thanks so much for being on The World Shapers. Enjoyed the chat. I hope you did too.
Oh, always. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And bye for now.
Okay.
Thanks again to Ira Naiman for that great conversation. That was a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it. This is where I remind you where you can find The World Shapers online. It is at theworldshapers.com, which is very likely where you just found this. And so you already know that, but maybe not, because of course The World Shapers is available through just about every podcast service out there. You should be able to track us down that way as well. Would like to also remind you that you can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers, that you can find it on Facebook, do a search for the World Shapers. You'll find both the World Shapers page, and you'll also find the World Shapers Facebook group, which I would love to get going more. It's a place where you can talk about the episodes with other listeners. And not a lot of action there right now, but it'd be great if that took off. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, ewillett. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. You can find me on Instagram at ecwillett. And just another reminder about the Kickstarter, which has now fully funded. There will be an anthology featuring authors who were guests on the first year of the World Shapers podcast. And having done this successfully once, I hope to try it again and do a second anthology down the road featuring the guests who will have been on the podcast in its second year. And that second year ends in August 2020, which is when I will be hopefully getting the anthology out that has just been successfully funded through Kickstarter. But you can still contribute to the Kickstarter, get a copy of that anthology, check out some of the great backers' rewards. It's at tinyurl.com/shapersofworlds, or just go to Kickstarter and look up Shapers of Worlds. And it ends at noon Central Standard Time, Mountain Daylight Time, on Monday. The stretch goals, which we are now into, for every $1,500 I get above the original goal of 13,500 Canadian, about 10,000 US, I will pay another cent a word Canadian to the authors who are contributing to the anthology. So that's a great way to help out an author. And, you know, I'm a big fan of writers getting paid, even when I'm the one doing the paying instead of the one being paid. I'm a big fan of that. So please check that out and come back to the World Shapers podcast going forward. Let's see. I just talked in the last couple of weeks. I've talked to S.M. Sterling, Barbara Hambly just this week. Nancy Kress is on the agenda. Brian Thomas Schmidt is coming up, and Adrian Laycraft. So there's lots of great episodes yet to come, and I'm talking to more authors, lining up more authors for after that. That's it for this episode of the World Shapers podcast, this special Kickstarter month episode. Thanks so much for listening, and come back often to listen to more authors talk about the creative process, how they create the amazing worlds and characters and adventures that we've all enjoyed so much over the years. That's it for this time. Bye for now.